Throughout the ages, history has been altered by word of mouth and the misrepresentation of those who might not have been present when some of the world's most significant events took place. Channelers Barry and Connie Strom bring through the spirits of those who actually witnessed or took part in these historical events and lets them tell their stories in their own words. Welcome to Channeling History. And now, here are your hosts, Barry and Connie Strom.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Channeling History. We're the only show where we speak to the souls that made things happen. And we're brought to you in the Parax Radio Network. I'm Barry Strom, your host, and I'll be doing the channeling tonight.
And I would like to thank you for tuning in to our show this evening. I'm Connie Strom, your co-host. This week, we will be learning about the American frontier from three spirits that are legends of the American West, Daniel Boone, Jim Bridger, and Kit Carson. If you enjoy American history, you will love this show. So please tell your friends about it so we can continue to expand our listeners.
Okay. We're going to do a short disclaimer. The opinions or statements voiced on our show are the channeled words of the spirits, do not necessarily reflect our opinions, those of the Parax Network, or of our sponsors.
Last week, we discussed the communication, the future of communications, by channeling the spirits of Alexander Graham Bell, Nikola Tesla, and Steve Jobs. If you missed the show, it is well worth listening to. There were three very intelligent souls.
Yeah, there was a lot of good information last week. All of our shows are available on our YouTube channel. It's in my name, Barry Strom. Or if you'd like to download them, go to Podomatic.com and just search for Channeling History. You can also hear us on Spotify, Audible, Pandora, iTunes, and many of the other platforms.
And we welcome your questions tonight through the chat room. While we do have questions prepared for our guests, we welcome your participation and look forward to your questions.
So when we begin channeling tonight, as usual, Connie's going to ask the questions, and I will answer the questions in the words of the spirits. But before we channel, as you probably know by now, we always say a prayer of protection. So Connie's going to say the prayer, and we're going to get started speaking to our three famous individuals.
God, please grant us your wisdom and protection. Grant us the knowledge that we can handle and keep us safe from all things that will harm us. Keep the messages positive and pure love. Keep us safe from our egos. We ask these things in the light of the seen, the unseen, and the honesty of God.
All right, Connie, as you know, I'm quite a history buff, so I'm really looking forward to this tonight. Let's start off with Daniel Boone. Mr. Boone was born in 1734 and he died in 1820. He's generally known for his exploration and settlement of the Kentucky area that was outside the western borders of the original 13 colonies. He blazed a trail through the Cumberland Gap into Kentucky in spite of the native resistance at the time. He served in the militia during the Revolutionary War. Many of us don't think about the frontiers being the Appalachian Mountains. But in the early 1700s, things were a whole lot different. So, Connie, if you have the first question for Mr. Boone, let's get started.
Okay. Mr. Boone, thank you for joining us this evening. Will you please tell us what the frontier of America was like prior to the Revolutionary War?
It was a very, very wild place. There were actually many, many Indian tribes in the area. The entire coastal area had been inhabited by Native Americans. And by the 1700s, they were realizing that white men represented their enemy, that the white people were advancing into their home areas, into their holy lands. And we're essentially just taking their properties. The Indians had a different concept of land ownership. They felt that the land was for everyone, where the British colonists felt that they wanted to possess the properties upon which they live and took the land from the native tribes. It was very dangerous. It was the French and Indian War was taking place. The British, or the French in this case, were recruiting the different Indian tribes to fight against the British colonists. Now, keep in mind, there was no United States until 1776. So we were all British subjects at the time. A lot of the properties or lands were not explored. The Appalachian Mountains represented a great barrier to Western colonization. It was a very, very wild and very difficult time.
Were you able to read or write?
No. In those days, there was no education on the frontier. You trusted your parents to try to help you. They would give you what they could if they could read and write. But if you were in a situation where your parents could neither read nor write, then it was not something that you were going to have the opportunity to learn. It was not until later, when things settled down and became safer for the colonists, that they would establish schools. But if you were truly on the frontier and basically on your own, there was no way that you could learn to read or write if your parents couldn't teach you.
What drew you to the Kentucky area?
I had always loved hunting and exploration in the mountains. Kentucky was on the other side of the Appalachian. Part of Kentucky was very mountainous, but once you get over the mountains, I'd heard stories that it was such a beautiful place. I had traveled into Kentucky, into the Ohio Valley, many of the places that were on the frontier at the time. But Kentucky, I thought, was especially beautiful. There was lush mountains. The flat areas were beautiful. They had plenty of water. Animals were everywhere at that time. It was just a wonderful area, and I felt that if we could find easy access to it over the mountains, that it would be a great place to expand and to live.
You were born near what is now known Reading in Pennsylvania. As a British subject, what was it like living as a British subject in that area?
Well, we were truly British subjects, and at that time, we weren't very... The oppression that the British did later in the 18th century was not as apparent as it was. We were on the frontier. As we moved westward, we were further from the centralized British rule. Keep in mind that the most difficult taxation was taking place in the cities on the ocean. Boston, Philadelphia, those were the big areas, the cities of the time, and that's where the problems with the British were beginning to take place. Now, we were expected to fight to protect, but we were protecting our homes, so service in a British militia was not a big deal. If you lived in the cities, then you had many more problems than those of us that lived on the frontier.
Will you tell us about your early interaction with the Native Americans?
In the beginning, as you say, I grew up in the Reading, Pennsylvania area, and the Indians of that in that location had been fairly friendly. We tried to get along with them as best we could because Indians could be very violent. There were many massacres. As you went further west in the Allegheny Mountains of Pennsylvania, it was much more dangerous. The Indian tribes in the western part, the Iroquois in particular, were warlike. They were very well organized, and they certainly resented the British subjects from taking their properties. I tried to learn as much about the Native Americans as I could, tried to learn their languages, did everything that I thought I would need to live on the frontier. If you were going to live on the frontier, you either had to be in constant danger or you had to be friendly with the Indians.
What was the opinion of the Native Americans when Americans began to settle the frontier towards Kentucky?
A lot of the property in the Kentucky area was what they considered their holy grounds. There was an awful lot of resentment, needless to say. When we first went into Kentucky, they were fairly friendly because we were a novelty. But as more and more individuals tried to follow the Western Road that we pioneered through the Cumberland Gap, they became more aware of people living on their properties and became much more unfriendly. You reached a point where we had to build basically a fort around our homes, and we had to be very much in guard. And as I look back, I certainly can't blame them for not being very happy that we were coming. We were trying to change their lives. They had a wonderful culture, and we were trying to convert them, sometimes with missionaries, to Christianity. We were doing many things. It just simply displaced them from their homes, and they fought back.
Understandable. Your family was a member of the Quaker Church. Would you please tell us what it was like being a member of the Quaker Church in early America?
The Quakers were probably one of the strictest religions. They believed strictly in the words of the Bible. On a Sunday, you would absolutely do no work. You would have to attend the church, and you would have to follow the rules of their congregations. If you didn't, you could be shunned, you could be thrown out of the church. The Quaker religion in those days was probably one of the most strict. They had come from Europe. They had tried to find areas of seclusion where they could follow their religions in peace. As civilization continued to move westward, many of the early church locations found out that they had to compete with other religions. But the Quakers were, it was a very difficult faith, and I found that I could no longer follow it.
You were known as an expert hunter. Why were you drawn to hunting rather than some other occupation?
I didn't take real well to book learning. My parents tried to teach me, but I just loved being in the mountains, in the woods. In those days, hunting was a real skill. Keep in mind that we were using smooth bores before we got to rifled hunting tools and weapons. You had to be able to stalk animals and get very close if you were going to be able to score on the animal in which you were hunting. Also keep in mind that wild animals represented a huge food source. It was a time where you had to clear the woods if you wanted to farm, and the animals were essentially free if you could hunt them down. It was a food source. It was incredibly valuable in pioneer America.
Did you play any role in the French and Indian War, which ran from 1754 to 1763?
Yes, I was part of a disastrous expedition in western Pennsylvania. I was watching out for the horses, so I didn't really get involved in the combat. But the British were beaten very badly. I tried to continue to serve in the British military, but thank goodness it was that one experience was enough. It was the first time that I really experienced any type of combat, and it was enough.
Yeah, what was your role in the Revolutionary War?
I served in the colonial military. Keep in mind that local militias played a huge role in fighting the Revolutionary War. I was involved in several battles. People will probably forget that the Revolutionary War lasted for so many years. We did what we could. we tried to fight the British where we could. By this time, the British had recruited some of the Indian tribes, so we had our hands full with them.
Yeah, in 1778, during the Revolutionary War, you were adopted into the Shawnee tribe. Will you tell us about that incident?
The Shawnees were on the other side, and I was actually captured in an incident with them. Since I was friendly with them, they adopted me into the tribe rather than treat me as a true enemy. I spent time with them. I tried to understand them. And then there was a time that I decided it was time to leave the tribe and get back to our home and our other existences. The Shawnees, they were mistreated like every other tribe, and they tried to stand up for their rights. I was accepted into them. I could speak their language. And in many instances, I was very sorry to see what happened to them.
Yes, I can imagine that. During your lifetime, the Appalachian Mountains were the American frontier. Just how dangerous was life in the American frontier during the 1700s?
There were times that it was incredibly dangerous. There were times that there were Indian massacres, that many white people were killed. We would try to stay close to our neighbors. Quite often we would build forts around our homes. There were times that it was very difficult to work in the fields. We would have to have lookouts. We would try to spy on the Indians and understand what their mood was and whether it was safe. So today when you drive through the Appalachian Mountains, it seems just like it's a wonderful, quiet place to be. But in the 1700s, it was far different. There were only several dirt roads through the area. The mountains represented problems in getting over. You had to try to cross at the gaps. It was the frontier. The frontier gradually moved west as more and more people came to live there. But the Appalachians were a very formidable structure to get over in those days. I helped put a road through a place called the Cumberland Gap, and that is the way that most of the people got into the area of Kentucky and Tennessee. But it was not a cakewalk by any stretch of the imagination.
I believe that. After the Revolutionary War, you worked as a surveyor and merchant. Will you tell us about that period in your life?
After the Revolutionary War, I was starting to get some years on. My eyesight wasn't as good as it was, and they said I'd try to get a real life and that I would attempt to settle down and raise a family. I speculated on land in Kentucky, and I made many mistakes. I got myself into financial trouble, and I would found myself in court for many years during that period of time.
To what do you attribute the fact that your name became so famous?
I think a lot of it was luck. I never really looked for fame, but as time went on, individuals looked to me to guide them into wilderness areas, to show them how to move about, showed them where the great properties were that I thought they should own, how the rivers work. I am very surprised that people still remember my name as much as they do. It wasn't like I was in the Continental Congress or a famous soldier, but I did help open the West during the 1700s.
You did. At the time you passed in 1820, the migration west of the Mississippi River was just beginning. As you watched from the other side, what was your opinion of the treatment of the Native Americans?
I knew they were going to be treated in the same way that they were on the East Coast. Americans would just simply take their lands. they would try and they would have treaties that they would break. I knew that it wasn't going to be good for them.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening and giving us some education here. Do you have a final message for us, sir?
I wish that things could have worked out better between the Indians and the colonial settlers. It was a difficult situation. You were dealing with two cultures that were so diametrically opposed. The Indians had the land that the white people wanted, and it was just about that simple, and they took it because there were so many more of them. I hope that the Americans of today realize the true beauty of the country in which they live, the mountains. I hope they preserve it. I hope they stop polluting all the incredible lands that we walked upon. When we were there, it was untouched. Today, it seems like humans are trying to create as much problems for the planet as they can. So thank you for having me. I appreciate this opportunity to speak, and have a good day.
Thank you, Mr. Boone.
Okay, Jim Bridger. He was born in 1804, died in 1881. Famous as an American mountain man, trapper, army scout, wilderness guide here in the United States. He explored the Rocky Mountains from what is now southern Colorado to the Canadian border. He began his fur trapping work in 1822 at the age of 18 years old. He built Fort Bridger, which Connie and I have visited several times. He was an incredible individual.
Welcome, Mr. Bridger. What was it like on the American frontier in the early 1800s?
Well, I was west of the Mississippi. I knew that there were incredible lands. I talked with other trappers that had been west. They told stories that I thought were total lies about the beauty, the size of the mountains. Keep in mind, the people that Daniel were living with, they considered that the Appalachian Mountains were so huge. They had no idea what laid out west in the Rocky Mountains. The huge American frontier was inconceivable. Lewis and Clark had explored it. They'd brought stories back. But it was just a truly amazing place. The plains were covered with buffalo. The mountains had grizzly bear. There were elk, deer everywhere. It was truly a land of plenty. And the Native Americans had thrived for thousands of years there on the beautiful animals that lived and they hunted. It was totally different from the eastern frontier. It was more rugged. The weather extremes were much different. It was just truly a gorgeous place to be.
Still is. Please tell us about your childhood.
I had a very difficult childhood. I was orphaned. Keep in mind, there was very little medical care. I grew up near the Mississippi River. I would hear the stories of the trappers. I was apprenticed to become a blacksmith. I tried to work at that job, but I just could not resist the urge to go west. These tales of beauty were just so much. It was just something that I had to do. I had a good mind. I could read a little bit. I could shoot very well. I was strong. And I figured the fur trade was something just I wanted to try.
How did the Indians treat the early fur trappers?
The fur trappers were just no real threat to the Indians. they would live like an Indian. They would come into the territory, and the trapping season was in the winter. They would basically live like an Indian. They would become accustomed to the traditions of the tribes that were close by. Many of the early trappers would take Indian wives. They were basically considered the same as an Indian. The early trappers, they took the furs, but they weren't really focused as much on the animals that were so valuable to the Indians. The buffalo were totally critical to the Western Indians' way of life. The Plains Indians relied on them. The traders were basically looking for the beaver hides. Beaver pelts, they made hats out of them, they exported it to Europe. In the early 1800s, trapping furs was very, very profitable. And the Indians, well, sometimes they would resent the trappers' presence, but basically the trappers got along with the Indians.
So what caused you to choose to join the fur trading industry?
There were trading expeditions that you could join. And it was a very profitable business. You would take your furs back and sell them, and you would have all the provisions you would need for another year. And if you wanted to be on your own, there was absolutely no business like trapping furs in the middle of the wilderness.
Will you tell us about a typical trapping season?
You would generally be part of an expedition of other trappers. You would go into this area, and you would break up the area into different locales for each individual trapper. You might control an entire river valley. The beaver were in these valleys, and you would build a cabin, a rough cabin. You would do what you could to prepare yourself for the winter months that you were coming, and you would trap these animals during the winter months. It was an incredibly difficult way of life. You had to be very tough. You had to know all of your surroundings. You had to be able to provide food for yourself. You would be hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the nearest trading post. So you were truly on your own. But if you succeeded, it was a very profitable way to make a living.
You were the first recorded white man to see the Great Salt Lake. What did you think when you first saw that?
I thought it was the Pacific Ocean. I had heard stories from the Lewis and Clark expedition. They had talked of it. It was salt water, and I stupidly thought that it was the Pacific Ocean. I didn't realize just how far it really was to the ocean. I thought it was a beautiful valley, and I told others about it.
You were the first explorer to see the wonders of what is now Yellowstone National Park. What did you believe when you saw the geysers?
I didn't know what to believe. We had never seen such things before. What is now Yellowstone Park was a place of incredible beauty. The mountains were teeming with animals. The beaver were plentiful. There were wolves, foxes, grizzlies everywhere. But here was this hot water. We had no idea what was taking place. No one had ever talked to us about geysers, or we simply had no way of ever understanding what we were looking at, but we knew that it was incredibly beautiful. When we would get back in the summers, back to the east where we would see others, we would tell them of it. I would actually act as a guide and bring parties to see the great beauty of the West at times.
It is amazing. In 1843, you founded Fort Bridger on the Green River section of what was then the Oregon Trail. Why did you leave the fur trapping to establish a fort for trading?
I felt, first of all, there was going to be a much easier life, that I didn't have to move around and wade around in icy water trying to catch beaver. I felt that I had had some background in blacksmithing, and by this time, there were many people coming through on the Oregon Trail. It was a long way between trading posts, and I felt that people in the caravans would need to pay for blacksmithing, for horse replacement, supplies, for many things. I thought that by creating a fort on the Oregon Trail, that I could lead a much more normal way of life.
Sounds like it was a great idea. In 1846, Brigham Young brought the Mormons to the Great Salt Lake Valley. How did you get along with the Latter-day Saints?
Well, in the beginning, pretty well. But I was like a couple hundred miles from Salt Lake City. In the beginning, they were busy just trying to get along and to live. But as they progressed, they became much more interested in commercial, shall we say, commercial enterprises. They realized that Fort Bridger was an important location on the Oregon Trail. And they also realized that I didn't want to have any part of their religion. I was friendly with the tribes. I got along well with them, and there were many things that I started to have disagreements with.
So would you tell us what happened to Fort Bridger in 1853?
The Mormons decided that they were going to take it over. I was warned by the Indian tribes, and I moved my family into the mountains and was protected. But they essentially took over my property and tried to control all of the commerce that was coming into the Salt Lake Valley.
In 1857, the United States had a disagreement with the Latter-day Saints that became known as the Utah War. Would you tell us what happened?
President Buchanan realized that war was coming with the South. He feared that the Mormons would side with the Confederacy, and he wanted to gain more control. The Mormons had their own militias, basically their own army. They were pretty much on their own, but civilization was catching up with them. He sent the military towards Salt Lake to assure that. The Mormons decided that they were going to fight back through guerrilla warfare. And they were actually, for almost a year, sniping back and forth at each other.
How did the Utah War affect you?
Well, I tried to stay out of it, but I certainly wasn't going to side with the people that took my property. It was important that the Indians did not decide that they were going to take violent sides in this. So I just tried to stand on the side and watch what took place.
Did you have any interaction with the Donner Party in 1846?
Yes, the Donners came through, and they were talking about this shortcut that they thought would get them to California faster. We thought that we weren't totally familiar with what he was talking about, but we felt that the beginning of their plan was satisfactory. And we told them that we thought the path would work for them. Sadly, it didn't. We gave them some bad information, and I'm very sorry that we did that, but we told them what we thought. Obviously, Donner got caught in the weather, and things didn't go well for him.
In 1868, you returned to Missouri, suffering from goiter and rheumatism. Please tell us about the final chapter of your life.
I went back to Missouri and lived with my daughter, and I was pretty miserable. I was losing my eyesight, and I actually went blind. For quite a few years, I was totally blind. My rheumatism, I could hardly get around. I had some incredible years, but sadly, the end of my life was very difficult.
As you look back on your life, what do you consider your finest accomplishment?
I had a very good mind for remembering terrain. I would draw maps of the area. I would then work as a guide. I led many expeditions through the West. I saw much of the country. I explored from, I guess what you call now Southern California, to Canada. I saw things. I was the first person to see many things. I got along well with the Indians. And I can think I contributed greatly to individuals that wanted to move into this great frontier that they called the West. I'm very satisfied, actually, with my life. I think that I helped many, many people to find homes in some of the most beautiful country in the world.
Can't argue with that. Thank you so much for joining us today. Do you have a final message for our listeners?
Yes. I want to thank you for the opportunity to come in through and speak to you. When I lived, it was an incredibly different time. I lived in a time that no one will ever see again. The plains of the Western country was covered with buffalo. The Indians would hunt the buffalo and live with them. Many of the tribes had wonderful cultures. Many of them were quite warlike when they started to realize that the Americans were going to be taking their properties and their lands. The American West in those days had a beauty that was incomprehensible. I was blessed to be able to see that beauty. I was blessed to be able to live among it. I was able to have many good friends. The fur trappers were a real brotherhood. They stuck together. They tried to look out for each other in some of the most dangerous environments known to man. But it was an inconceivable place. I wish that all of you could have an opportunity to see it, but sadly, it's too late for that. So thank you for allowing me to speak. Thank you for allowing me to describe the miracles that I watched in life.
Thank you for sharing all of that with us.
Okay, our third guest tonight is going to be Kit Carson. He was born in 1809 and he died in 1868. He was also a frontiersman, also a fur trapper, a soldier, Indian agent. And as with our other two guests, he had a profound effect on the Western migration. He became very famous. There were novels and books written about him. And perhaps his best namesake today is Carson City, Nevada. So, Kit Carson, welcome to our show.
Thank you, sir, for joining us. Well, what was the American West like in the early days where you were?
Jim did a pretty good job of describing it. The American West was a very, very wild place. In the beginning, there was no law and order. That all came later. In the beginning, you were taking your life in your own hands. By the time that I started to work along the Santa Fe Trail. The Indians were very dangerous to the white men. The area of the trail was to the south. I spent a lot of my life in Taos and what is now New Mexico. I was part of expeditions to California. California in those days was the most beautiful place. If you were born in the interior of the country, you saw flat plains. Once you saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time, it was amazing. I grew up in Missouri, where we just simply had rolling hills. We crossed the Rocky Mountains, which were thousands and thousands of feet high. We tried to do what we could to open the West, to bring people out. And we did many things that I would look back on. I was very sad that I did. But it was a time of beauty, and it was a time of danger.
Yeah, you grew up in Missouri when it was part of the American frontier. How dangerous was Missouri in those days, and how did that affect your opinion towards the Indians?
We had Indian uprisings in Missouri in the early 1800s. I saw many people that were killed by the Indians. I grew up having a great dislike for them. I grew up in many ways fearing what they could do. In those days, attitudes were so much different. It was a time where basically it became them or us. It was a time that it was accepted that you could simply kill them. And they could kill us as easy. But I grew up at a time that we had to have forts built around our homes in Missouri. It was on the eastern side of the Mississippi, so we got civilized a lot more rapidly than the west of the Mississippi. But it was a time that I made opinions that lasted for a long part of my life.
You were apprenticed as a saddler. How did the apprentice system work, and how did it work out for you?
When you were an apprentice, you signed a contract that you were going to work with the individual that was going to teach you a trade. It was an obligation. You worked for him. You would be paid minimal. His pay was going to be the education he was passing back to you. In my case, I was apprenticed as a saddler. Everyone had a horse in those days, so it was a very good business. But I would see the traders coming back. I would see the settlers heading to the west. I would hear the incredible stories. I had a chance to join an expedition of fur traders. So I ran off from my position as an apprentice and joined that expedition.
I think you answered my next question about why did you decide to join the fur traders? Did you enjoy the fur trapping?
Yes. It was an incredibly difficult way of life. You were with some of the greatest mountaineers in the world. They taught me how to trap. In the beginning, I would basically tend their horses, but they were very outgoing. They taught me the trade. I joined their fraternity, and for quite a few years, I spent my winters in the high mountains trapping beaver. It was an incredible time.
Will you tell us about the Rocky Mountain Rendezvous?
There was a time that the trader, each year, at a designated place, that the buyers from the east would set up this large encampment. All of the fur traders would come to this rendezvous and bring their hides. The buyers would purchase the hides. Some of them would be merchants. They would bring goods. You would trade. You would use what you got for your hides to buy items that you would need for the next winter. It was an incredible place. There was no shortage of liquor and booze. We would party with our friends. The rendezvous was an incredible part of American history in the early 1800s.
Did you know Jim Bridger?
Everybody knew Jim Bridger in that area of the country. He would come to the rendezvous. He was very, very well known. He was considered one of the best trappers of the time. He was considered a straight shooter. He was quite famous, and I did spend some time with him.
You spent much of your time on the Santa Fe Trail. Will you tell us about life on that trail?
The Santa Fe Trail basically came around the southern edge of the Rocky Mountains. It came through an area which would bring you into Southern California. The trail had many, many danger spots in it. There were deserts. There were places of short water supplies. It was also an area that where the Apaches were living and highly resented the presence of the white man. It was a very dangerous place. The Apache were very, very warlike. The Southern Utes were not real pleased with what was taking place. The trail came to the south, so in the summer it was very, very hot. There were places, as I said, that were incredibly dangerous to cross. But I knew the area. I helped guide through the area, and it provided some wonderful homesteads for people.
Would you tell us about being hired by John C. Fremont?
Fremont's expeditions were intended to explore California. He was actually quite famous, and I worked for him on several of his expeditions. It was an incredibly interesting time. I saw areas of California that were gorgeous. We would escort settlers. We would protect them from the Indians. We had many, many skirmishes with Indian tribes. We fought them. We actually terminated many of the Indians. We did things that, as I look back on, were terrible. But we did it believing that we were protecting the lives of the settlers.
How did his expeditions affect your life?
It brought out my abilities as a guide, as a frontiersman. And actually, some of the reporters of the Times started to write some novels about what I was doing. I was joining in. I was very, very active in fighting the Native Americans in California. I would guide famous people. I would do many things. But Fremont actually brought me to the public's eye. He was an incredible pioneer, and he accomplished very, very much in opening the California and Santa Fe Trail areas to settlers.
You had multiple Native American wives, yet you participated in events such as the Sacramento River Massacre and the Klamath Lake Massacre against indigenous peoples. Why did you participate in such events?
We were at war with the Indians. As I said, I had a strong dislike of Indians in my youth. It started from my time in Missouri, and we were continuously being attacked by the different tribes when we were moving on the Santa Fe Trail. In California, there were many Indian tribes, and they were very, very resentful. They would kill settlers. They would massacre them. They would torture them. They would do many, many things that I cannot describe. We considered the Indians that were creating these acts as less than human. And we felt that the only way to protect the settlers were to wipe out their tribes. There were times that we killed women, children. We did terrible, terrible things to them. But they had done terrible things to some of the white settlers as well. There was no attempt made to find peaceful coexistence with them. Whenever the white man would make a treaty with them, they would break it. The Indians had no trust in the white man, and it was just a terrible, terrible time.
Yeah, why did your attitude towards the Indians soften as you grew older? What caused that?
I realized that they were humans. I had actually married some Indian women. When you were a fur trapper, you would often take a wife, maybe only for that winter. But it was the only way that you would ever have company during that cold winter where you were trapping the beaver. I learned multiple languages of the Indians. And as I grew older, I started to understand that they weren't all bad. They were simply trying to protect their way of life. I realized as I grew older that much of what I believed about them was wrong. Once you understand that they were simply trying to protect their families, their ways of life, you start to realize that there are two sides to every story.
You were the subject of many articles and novels that created a bit exaggerated image of your exploits. How did you react to these articles and novels?
I was totally shocked. They were actually writing about me, and I didn't even know that that was taking place. I saw these small books and realized that they were talking about my own exploits. They were exaggerated to the greatest degree, but apparently the people back east were so stupid that they believed a whole bunch of what they were reading. But people had to actually read them to me. I couldn't read or write, so I was really caught off guard by it.
In your opinion, what was your effect on the Western migration?
I think I served a great service in guiding people. I guided military expeditions. I helped make it safe for the white settlers. I think that I was very, very effective.
Throughout your younger years, you took great pride in killing Indians. How were you judged for this when you returned to heaven?
They did not look on that part of my life with great expectation, shall we say. I accumulated karma that I will have to pay when I decide to return. Many of the things I did in my younger years were wrong. And my guides were very quick to point that out to me when I returned home.
From 1854 to 1861, you acted as a federal Indian agent. Tell us about your life as an Indian agent and your vision of the future for Native Americans.
I felt that the Native Americans should be educated, should be converted to Christianism, should be kept on reservations. I tried to do all that I could at that point in my life to be fair to the Indians. I had fought them. I had killed them. I realized that I had done many things to hurt them. I tried to use my reputation to help the Native Americans. What happened to them from the period during up to the Civil War was very violent. I tried to do my best to get food for them. I used many of my own resources for it. I tried to be a very fair agent for the Indians. I feared for their future. I realized that if they continued to fight the United States Army, that they would be defeated and possibly even driven to extinction. By the end of my life, I had totally changed in my opinion towards Native Americans.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Mr. Carson. Do you have a final message for us?
Yes, I want to thank you for allowing me to speak. We lived in a very, very different time. We acted in a very, very different way, and many times we did not do what is right. When you look at the way that we lived and what we did in the eyes of modern moralities, you are revolted by much of what took place. The Native Americans in the entire continent were totally mistreated. The white man came and they took their lands. The white man did what they needed to do to colonize. Native Americans were mistreated since white man put his first foot on this continent, and they continue to be mistreated. I would like to still see the government treat the Native Americans fairly. They are still abused. They are still hurt. And I am very sorry for what I did to help probably set some of the trends. We try to influence people to do right by them today, but it is still a very sad picture. But thank you for allowing me to come through. Just remember that things were totally different in the days when we lived. Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you, sir, for sharing your knowledge with us.
Okay, next week, I'm kind of on a Western binge right now, so we're going to be channeling the spirits of three famous Western heroes, just from a little bit later time periods. We're going to speak with Wyatt Earp, Bill Hickok, and Buffalo Bill Cody. This should be a really, really interesting show as well. And I want to especially thank you, our three friends that were with us tonight. You can submit questions through our email. It's channelinghistoryonparax@gmail.com. I've got 9 books on Amazon. They cover all subjects. They're on Kindle. It'd be really nice if somebody would buy some of them. Signed copies are available on my website, spiritspredict.com.
All of our shows are available on our YouTube channel in the name of Barry Strome. If you want to download them, you can just go to podomatic.com and search Channeling History.
Okay, thank you so much, everybody, for listening in. Please tell your friends about our show. Join us Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Pararex Radio Network.
Good night.
Thanks for listening to Channeling History. Tune in again next week for another electrifying episode, as we never know who will make an appearance or who will come through the portal. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2020. Our story begins by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.